Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebel. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hey, listeners. Today, with me, I have Melanie Diesel. She's an expert in native advertising and content marketing. Hey, Melanie.
Hey there.
Welcome to the show, and how are you today?
Pretty good. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I don't know. I'm looking at a picture of you drinking a coffee, and I'm just picturing, are you drinking a coffee right now?
I absolutely am.
You absolutely are. It just happened. I'm on the website just looking at some of your stuff, and I'm like, okay, I wonder if she's drinking a coffee right now.
Almost always.
Almost always. How many cups do you drink per day?
You know, I only have one cup of caffeinated coffee a day. I had to cut back a little bit, but, you know, I have my first with caffeine, which is now, and then I'll switch to decaf for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I think I've had the same thing. I don't know why, but it just creeps up, right? Like you start drinking all this stuff and energy drinks, and after a while you're just like, hold on a second, I think I'm just too wired right now.
I think my heart's going to explode.
Yeah. Can you explain to the listeners first what native advertising is and then how you define content marketing?
Yeah, absolutely. So native advertising is actually, you know, a pretty broad category. It generally refers to any advertising that's native to its context. So that depends, obviously, on what the context is. You know, if you're on Twitter, then what's native there is a tweet. So you have promoted tweets. You know, same thing on Facebook, a promoted story or promoted post. In my context, I'm usually working with publishers, you know, newspapers, magazines, and websites. And what's native in that context is actually content. So that could be an article, a video, an infographic, or anything similar to that. So, you know, when I'm working with the publishers that I've worked with in the past, you know, I used to work at Time Inc., at Huffington Post, the New York Times. What was native advertising in that environment was content sponsored by a brand that lived on the publisher's websites.
Interesting. And is that usually something that you have to buy straight from that website, or are you still using like the display network and some of these other external platforms?
No, these are usually pretty custom, you know, straight through with the publisher you want to partner with. You reach out to them, you try to come up with, you know, a content concept that's going to work, that's going to appeal to the audience and still align obviously with your marketing goals as well. But yeah, it's usually a pretty high touch program. It's a lot of hands on, creating something that's really custom.
So let's start digging into that. How would you, as a business person, evaluate where to publish, what to publish?
Yeah, you know, the key thing is so many publishers, they think similar to how they think of PR. Where do we want to be featured, right? Where do we want to get to say we've worked with? And that's wonderful when you're talking about PR, but when you're investing your time, money, and other resources in creating custom content, you want it to be somewhere that actually captures your ideal audience and is going to serve your marketing goals. So you want to take a look at, you know, with this campaign, with this product we're launching or initiative we have, who do we actually want to reach? And then think about who, from a publisher standpoint, do those people already know, like, and trust? And that's where you want to try to find your publishing partner, somewhere that when you publish your article or your infographic or whatever else, it's going to be reaching your ideal target demographic from a content perspective with that publisher. And then what you want to do is figure out, you know, there's two things. There's the message you want to send to those folks, and then you have to think about what are the native topics and concepts from a content standpoint that makes sense in that context anyway. So the kind of content that you're used to finding, even editorially on somewhere like BuzzFeed, is different than what you do on the New York Times. Or, you know, when you're reading Sports Illustrated, your expectations as a reader are very different than when you're reading the Wall Street Journal. So you've got to think about what makes sense from a content standpoint. What do readers expect to find there? And then the ideal branded content that you'd create, the ideal native advertising, is going to be somewhere in the overlap of those two things. So a story idea that fits the context, that is something those readers would be interested in, but ultimately also aligns with your marketing goals as well.
So do you have a formula or plan or some initial questions that you would ask a client so they can start wrapping their head around it?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, obviously we want to know some of the key things about the campaign, just the basic stuff. So when do you want this content to go live, right? Because if we have 1 week to do something, what we're capable of creating in that time frame is very different than if we have 3 months or 6 months. So the time of when you want that content to go live is very important. You also want to understand the budget, right? So again, you know, if we have $100,000, that might be very different what we could create with that budget than if we had $1 million or $2 million. So, you know, you want to think about what is feasible within your time frame and your budget. And then from there, you start to ask other questions like, you know, is this an example of a time where you'd want to inform your audience? Is there, you know, a high barrier to entry? If you're talking about something like cloud computing, you know, you might need to provide a lot of information in order to help people understand. But maybe it's something more commonplace and you're more inclined to try to entertain your audience. They don't necessarily need a ton of information to understand what you're selling, but it might be a good opportunity to have some fun with them, to, you know, make them laugh, make them smile. So, you know, those kinds of things, just understanding the limitations in terms of your budget and your time frame, and then understanding, you know, how are you hoping to interact with your audience? Are you wanting to come away feeling informed or amused? With the publishing partner you choose.
So.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
They have like $1,000 budget for a whole month. What could be an easy win for them?
You know, truthfully, a lot of native advertising, it tends to be very expensive. You know, so if you're working with a $1,000 budget, then it's possible branded content may not be the best option for you, especially if your goals for that campaign are something very direct response. You know, if you're hoping to drive clothing sales, you may even be better off just running some targeted Facebook ads to try to reach your ideal audience and show them images of what these beautiful clothes you create look like, or, you know, maybe working with an influencer who's in the fashion and lifestyle space who can, you know, capture your target audience and show them, you know, all the different looks that you can create with these items. So at that budget point, you know, you want to look for what's going to be most effective. And if you're not going for more of an awareness play, you know, then maybe that kind of content is not the right play. You know, in an environment where perhaps this fashion company has won some sort of award or a grant, or they've just been infused with funding, and they're saying, okay, well, you know, given that we want to reach women who are in the 18 to 30 range, maybe we should consider some branded content on Refinery 29, where, you know, we know that our target audience is reading, they're going to Refinery 29 for fashion and lifestyle advice. And perhaps if we were to do something about, you know, day to night looks that work for work as well as, you know, a night out on the town, then that kind of content would be at home on Refinery 29. It would reach the target audience. And, you know, that kind of content might ultimately serve the marketing goals of reaching a new audience and showing them all the versatility that your line has.
Okay, great. So it's out of reach for them at that point. So let's say they've done the advertising on Facebook. They grew. They're making, let's say, $1 million or $2 million a year now. They have a budget of between $50,000 and $100,000. Same company, niche clothing.
Yep.
They come back to you. Now, what do you say? What's the easy win there?
Yeah, oftentimes I wouldn't say that, you know, creating brand content with a publishing partner is usually an easy win. Like I said, it tends to be, you know, much more hands-on. It's a long process. It sometimes takes weeks or months to come up with a piece of content that both parties are happy with, that's going to fit the audience and suit the marketing goals. So, you know, again, I think it's just a balance of understanding what your goals are and recognizing the limits of what you know, a piece of content can do. Because, you know, most of us, when we're reading articles or, you know, looking at an infographic, watching a video, we're not necessarily expecting a hard sales message, right? Like we're expecting to be informed or entertained. And so, you know, what might be interesting is, you know, if this clothing line, for example, had a really original origin story, you know, maybe the person who's designing these clothes changed careers at 40 years old and suddenly became a fashion designer. That would be really interesting for readers to know about, you know, if they could align with the mission, you know, and get behind the founder's story. Or perhaps you're using really unusual ingredients, maybe, or not ingredients, but, you know, elements that you're using that are, you know, maybe eco-friendly. You know, maybe there's some sort of underlying mission there that you could use content such as an interview or, you know, a factory tour on video. You know, that content could be really useful for informing the audience that, hey, we're doing something different with our brand.
So Since there are no easy wins, and you mentioned the process, what would that process typically look like?
So the process generally starts with a brand or their agency on their behalf sending an RFP, a request for proposal. So that's the document where they send out to all the various ad partners and say, hey, we have this much money and we want to accomplish these goals and we're hoping to have this campaign live during this time frame. They would send that out to a number of potential advertising partners, and that could include websites, magazines, influencers, all kinds of things. The publisher that receives that would, you know, take some time to say, what could we create for this brand that would make sense for our readers, that our readers would enjoy and love and engage with? And they would send those proposals back to the brand or the agency, whoever's sending it out on their behalf. And then the brand would get to evaluate and say, well, with this budget, we could take out one commercial during the Super Bowl, or we could buy, you know, a whole ton of Facebook ads. We could do an article with Refinery29, or we could do a video series on the InStyle website. So, you know, so they would get to evaluate, you know, which of these do we think will best serve our goal? And, you know, maybe they end up choosing multiple, you know, kind of scaling back a little bit and doing multiple of their proposed plans. Once the deal is sealed, you know, you've signed the paperwork and you said, yes, we definitely want to work together and create some content together. Then you move into the production phase. And the production phase really depends. It could be a few weeks. It could be a few months. It just depends on how in-depth that content is. You know, making a 10-part video series takes a lot longer than making just one article. So, you know, there'll be back and forth where the creators on the publisher side will start making that content. They'll share various drafts of it with the brand and their agency to get approvals and feedback and suggestions. And then once it's ready to go, you set that content live on the publisher's properties and begin distributing it through on-site ads, through social ads, and more to make sure that the ideal audience is actually seeing all of that content you worked so hard to create.
How long does this process typically take?
So it really depends. I mean, if as a brand, you have a very clear idea of what it is you want to create, and, you know, you're talking about something that's fairly quick to create. For example, an interview with the founder is perhaps something you could pull together very quickly. You know, you could have something live in a number of days. Like I said, say you're doing, you've decided we want to do a video documentary about our debut at Fashion Week in Milan. Well, that might take a little bit longer. You've got to wait for the event to happen. You've got to go and film everything. You've got rounds of editing those videos to make sure that they, you know, come together in the way that you hope as a brand. And then you've got to set it live. So it could be several months before that content idea comes to life.
God, you know, there's some shaking going on behind you on your side. Any idea what that could be? If just something like rattling a little bit.
Are you still hearing it?
Not at the moment, no.
Okay.
Okay, maybe you have big earrings on. How do you define quality content? Because I'm coming from the Google school of thought, right? So we want to rank this content. But I would imagine you need quality content in this field too. So how would you, you know, talk to a client about this?
I think the quality comes down to a number of things. I mean, first, you want to make sure that the mission is aligned so that you really are trying to produce something that is going to serve your audience, right? Because, you know, a lot of times brands think of storytelling as sort of a backdoor way to selling. And, you know, if you're sort of, it comes across pretty quickly. You know, your readers will notice or your viewers will notice if, you know, you're sort of faking the storytelling for a few minutes and then going right into a hard sell. So I think it really has to be in service of your audience. The next thing is you want to make sure that you're using reputable sources. So, you know, for our fashion example that we were using before, you want to talk to fashion designers and get their take. You know, you want a fashion editor who has some experience, you know, giving their insights on the different fashion line and the materials that are being used, you know, and, you know, you want high quality imagery to be paired along with that. So, you know, the reputable sources are a big part, making sure that you have voices that are, you know, have the authority to speak about the things they're speaking about. And I think, you know, most of the good stories that we really connect with, they have a human element, right? They're about people, or there's people's perspectives being weaved into those stories. And so I think, you know, those elements, you know, having reputable sources, having a true service mentality that you're really trying to create something that benefits your audience, and then having that human element so that people can relate to it and connect to it. I think all those are very important.
Yeah, it seems like we can take a lot of angles when we create the content. Is there a blueprint that you kind of lean on pretty heavily, something that's sort of solid and always, well, not always, there's no such thing as always, but works most of the time they use?
You know, it's one of the things that's really challenging, but also really exciting about branded content is that there is really no surefire blueprint, right? Even with editorial content, you know, we've all seen articles or videos, some that we love and some that we don't love so much. So, you know, it is a little bit more of an art than a science. I think one of the things you can fall back on is, broadly speaking, there are three types of content. I use PRE to help people remember, like pre. So at the base is the product-focused content. That's anything about your products, your services, what you're selling. The next level is the R. That's the role you play in your customer's life. So what are you helping them to do? What are you helping them to accomplish? And then the E is the emotional content. What do you make your audience feel? You know, what are you trying to change in their mindset, in their feelings, in their heart? So if you have a good balance between that product content, role content, and content about the emotions that you help provoke, you know, that is generally something you want to work on a balance of. If you have too much content on the product side, your audience is going to feel like, oh, they're all about themselves. They're not really helping me at all. They're not talking about me in my life. We all care about ourselves, right? So we want to recognize that in our audience. But at the same time, if you're all the way on the other side and all your content is emotional, we might wonder what you're selling to begin with. You know, great, I see that I'm going to feel confident and cool, you know, when I work with you, but what does that even mean? You know, what are you selling to me? So it has to be a balance between product, role, and emotional content.
Would you say this works better for branding or to actually get someone to come over and buy something? Because it seems like there's not much room for a strong call to action in one of these articles.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, it does tend to be a little more top of funnel. You know, it's more about awareness and engagement. But it's not unheard of for there to be great, really conversion-based content, more bottom funnel content. Those generally happen in more of a lifestyle or magazine environment. You know, I always say when we open a magazine, especially like a women's lifestyle magazine, we expect brands to have a presence there. You know, we're going there for recommendations of clothes to wear and products to use. And so for a brand to be there offering more bottom funnel advice, it's okay. It makes sense. We're comfortable with that because brands usually have a presence there anyway.
Do you find smaller businesses would have a more niche magazines or websites or going for a bigger audience? So like I'm thinking about the clothing still, right? Mm-hmm. Just for that. Like if it's like sporting stuff, like so maybe there are websites that tell people what to pack for travel versus just a fashion sports magazine.
Right. Yeah. And this is what we were talking about earlier, how it's always a balance of figuring out where is your audience and then what do you have the budget to create. So, you know, if you're more of a sporting type fashion brand, you could go to Sports Illustrated, you know, you'd reach a massive audience, but those may not be the perfect audience for you. You might be better off, like you said, on a smaller blog that really focuses specifically on sports travel. If you're traveling, you know, you're hiking, you're backpacking, you're going on a camping trip, you know, they may have a smaller overall audience, but the folks that they capture might be perfect for what you're looking for. So it is always that balance between finding the right audience and finding enough of your right audience.
How would you insert a call to action in one of these? Like something that's not super, I guess, in your face, mm-hmm. but where you can still maybe get people to go over to your own website, right? Because I think that's the challenge here. You know, sure. They'll read a story about the founder and they're like, oh, wow, this is good. You know, it tickled my heart a little bit, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to that website. Therefore, there's no sale being made and the funnel stops right there.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things you can do really efficiently is actually retarget based on content. So, you know, if I've read your founder story and I'm already sort of into the brand, I believe in what you're doing and I think it's interesting, then, you know, a week later when I get hit with an ad and I say, oh, I remember that brand. I read about them. You know, now I might be ready to buy. But within the content, you can always do something that's a little softer. So a great example is, you know, given our example here, if we have a photo in that article of the founder wearing the clothes and the caption says, you know, top is from our brand, you know, jeans are from our brand, shoes are from our brand, and there's a link to buy here. If I see that and I say, I love this look, I want to shop this look, I can do that right there. Oftentimes, a coupon code is another really great measurable way to do that. So at the end, it says, if you want to learn more about our brand, you know, and you want to try some looks, here's a coupon code for 20% off your first order. Now, you know, if I've read through all the way to the bottom of the content and I'm, you know, I'm obviously very deeply engaged, I believe in the brand, I'm interested in the brand, and now you're offering me with some value, then it's much more likely that I'll take the extra step to go and convert into a customer.
I like that you mentioned remarketing. What message would you send? So let's say that they read the founder article. So would you hit them with the same type of message? Would you differ that a little bit? I'm curious. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a very specific example, right? But, you know, what might work really well is, since I'm already familiar with the founder at this point, right? I've seen perhaps his or her face, you know, I believe in what they're doing, then an ad, you know, that could be much more direct response, but includes a photo of that founder, is the kind of thing that would make me say, ah, yes, I recognize this brand. I know this brand. I know that person. And so now, you know, I'm much more likely to then go and convert because I'm familiar. I recognize it and I perhaps see myself in it because there's that human element. You know, maybe I'm also starting my own company, or, you know, some parts of that founder's story resonate with me personally. So seeing that reminder of like, yes, I know this person. And oh yes, they are the founder of a company that I can buy from.
So let's say we've done that. They read the founder's story. We targeted them with the founder picture. Where on that website would you send that person then?
You know, where on the fashion website?
On the website of that founder. So for example, would you do it to an about page, to some kind of a landing page? Like, which portion of the website then would you send someone through, right? So it still follows that same funnel so people don't get confused.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You know, I think if you had a multi-step retargeting where the first step is you're sending me to the about page to read more about the founder, then maybe the following week you're sending me right to a shopping cart where I can see an item that's pictured in the ad. That kind of thing could work. It could also work, you know, with a shorter funnel as well, where, you know, the photo that comes up in my Facebook feed is the founder wearing a specific jacket and you're saying, you know, our founder, Kate, loves this jacket, you know, click here to see if it comes in your size or something like that. You know, it could definitely be much more direct response on that first follow-up because, again, I'm already familiar. So maybe I don't even need to read more about the founder. Maybe I'm already bought in because I just read, you know, a pretty long article. I committed myself to going all the way to the bottom.
I've seen on your website that you mentioned great brand storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I think every brand would want to do great storytelling. So what differentiates the good ones from the bad ones? And can you give some examples of some great storytelling done by brands?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think what differentiates great brand storytellers is a willingness to serve the audience. So if you think about journalists, for example, you know, your favorite magazine, your favorite website, you go there because the content connects to you, right? You feel like this serves me. It either entertains me or it informs me. It makes me a better person or a smarter person or whatever that content does for you. You'll feel the same way about brands if they're showing up with that same intention. So, you know, for me, for example, you know, because I'm an entrepreneur, I read a lot of content about entrepreneurs. You know, I'm reading profiles of founders. I'm reading recommendations for products and tools. I'm reading tips on things to make my business more efficient. So if a brand were to show up and say, hey, we offer this tool and here's how it can change your business, then that is something that would appeal to me because it's just like the editorial content that I know and love. But in order to do that, a brand might have to say, you know, might have to tell a story that's not directly about their products and services, at least to start. You know, we talked about the remarketing. That's a really smart way to do it, where you start at the top of the funnel and guide us all the way down. You know, I think generally speaking, like I said, a lot of it is about that intention. When we as readers or viewers feel like someone is trying to provide us with some value, we can feel that. It feels different than someone who's just trying to sell. You know, it's almost the same experience. I'm sure we've all had this in our email, right? If someone sends you an email where they're just asking you for a favor out of the blue, you're sort of like, well, who are you to ask me something, right? Like, what are you doing in my inbox just asking me for a favor? We don't know each other. So it's similar for content, right? If a brand shows up and says, hey, I've got a tip that's going to help you be more efficient in your business, then you're like, oh, I like you. You're trying to help me. If they show up in your inbox and say, hey, try a demo of our product, you're like, who are you? What are you doing? So, you know, it's that same intention, that desire to provide value. So a great example is there's a coffee company called Blue Bottle Coffee. And they have a number of stores, but they also sell coffee online. They actually launched a full course, so a free online course you can take to learn more about coffee so that you feel like I know the difference between, you know, a light roast and a dark roast, or I have some questions about what kind of coffee grinder, what kind of coffee pot should I have. Now, technically, that course doesn't sell Blue Bottle coffee, right? There's no direct call to action that says buy our beans here. But I now feel like Blue Bottle is a company that gets me, that wants to provide value. So now I trust their recommendations because they provided value first. When I'm in the market for a coffee cup or a coffee grinder or, you know, pounds of coffee, I know that there's someone I can trust, that they're making recommendations, that they understand me and my needs. And so, you know, that's a great example of a company providing free content that is truly just service, right? They're just trying to provide information and value to their readers. But ultimately, it helps down the line, you know, convert us into customers because we feel like we have a connection with that brand, that they've provided value to us.
Do you have any books or resources that you recommend to people about storytelling, how to write a great story?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of great content out there. I think one of the most important things, and my background is as a journalist, so when I think of content, the first thing I think of is written content. Obviously, there's fantastic videos and infographics and ebooks and all kinds of stuff, but I think the most important thing is to consume the best stuff of whatever it is you want to produce. So if you want to be writing better, then consume the best writing out there, right? Read, whether it's a novel or, you know, an article or a full-on book, whatever it is, just read the best stuff out there. And it could even be in different topics, different verticals. The more you see good examples of good content, the more you'll strive to create content like that. So, you know, you want to be creating great video, then you should be subscribed to a bunch of YouTube channels, even if they're not on your exact topic, to understand what is it about this that I think is fun or enjoyable, or why did I really like this video? Why did I feel like I should share this video? What was it that made me feel like it was special? And how can I emulate that in my own content? Two very specific books that I love. One is called Everybody Writes by Anne Handley. It's really aimed at folks who might not think they're storytellers, might not think they're writers, but kind of helping them come to understand that you are absolutely a writer. You write every day of your life in emails and text messages and everywhere else, and helping you find, you know, that special sauce that can make your writing even more powerful. And another great one is a new book, actually, called The Storytelling Edge, and it's by the two folks over at Contently. So that's a great new book that's all about brand storytelling. So both of those, I think, would be great resources for folks who want to kind of up their storytelling game.
That's awesome. So you're doing speaking and consulting. How do you use all this knowledge that you have to market your own stuff?
Sure. So, you know, I try my best to walk the walk, to practice what I'm preaching here. So, you know, my goal is never to step up on stage or even come on a podcast like this and kind of just talk about myself or sell myself. My goal is to provide as much value as I can, whether it's through guest blogging or speaking on stage, to just try to help people see that I want people to love storytelling as much as I do. And if that resonates with them, then there's probably a good chance we could work together and work together well if we both care about the same thing deeply.
Yeah, I mean, I do appreciate that. I usually drop the interviews that don't provide any value. It does happen from time to time. What's been something that gave you a big ROI?
You know, I guess it's tough to say. It's different for every brand, right? Because where you want to be spending your time and money is on the things that are working best for you. And
no, working best for you.
For me? I guess, you know, I measure ROI in a different way. What's really important for me is impact. I always joke that, you know, when you get into journalism, which is where I started, you never really get into it for the money. It's not a very well-paying job. So I'm lucky in that my driving force really is service. I try to show up in service of my audience. So, you know, the speaking stuff is great for me. I love to get up there, and I have a room full of 100 or 1,000 people who want to know more about storytelling. And so if I can climb off that stage and feel like I've made people believe in the power of stories and believe that they too are storytellers, then for me, that's the best ROI I can hope for, is being able to impact people so that they can go back to their jobs and feel empowered to do that better.
So instead of giving them fish, teach them how to fish.
It's true. Yeah.
You know, in the current climate, I can't imagine it being easy to just be a journalist, you know, all the fake news jokes aside.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, journalism has never been the most lucrative career to get into. Like I said, you know, even when I remember when I was in college studying journalism, they always make those lists of like the worst careers. And we were always pretty high up as the worst career as journalists. So, you know, it's one of those things, like I said, you have to be driven by something deeper. And, you know, for some people, it's very specific. It's a love of sports that makes them want to become a sports reporter, you know, or a love of the arts that makes them want to become a movie critic. So, you know, we're generally driven by there's something a little strange about us, I think, because we're driven by something else, by a passion and a desire to help others, I think.
Well, there's something weird about being a business person, too.
Mm-hmm.
I feel there's a disconnect between businesses and journalists, right? So as a journalist, you're thinking of giving the best news to your audience. And as a business person, you're trying to sell things all the time.
Sure. Yeah. One of the examples I find myself making a lot is kind of like a dating analogy. You know, if you're out on the market, you're trying to find your person in this world. There's a lot of options for you. You know, you can go to a bar and just randomly ask random people to go home with you. And a lot of marketing is kind of like that, right? Like you were saying, there's sort of this false promise and it doesn't really matter who it is. We're just trying to get the numbers, right? But if you're trying to create a connection with someone, it takes more time. You have to listen, you have to engage, you have to ask questions and provide value and, you know, build a relationship slowly over time. And those are the ones that last, right? Those are the ones that have staying power. And it's true for your customers as well. You know, if a marketer, you know, has it in their mind that, well, it doesn't matter who it is, I just want to get a million views. Well, those million views are probably not going to give you what you're looking for. You know, that's not going to turn into sales or turn into, you know, long-term customers because you're focused on the wrong metrics. And so I try to just remind marketers, you really have to think about what you want to accomplish. Is this a numbers game or is it about creating deep engagement with the right customers?
How do you approach guest posting? Since that's one way that we get backlinks and get our names out there too.
I think a lot of it depends on the goals. I think, you know, guest posting is really great for growing your awareness with a new audience. Native advertising is the same, but you generally have a broader audience because there's paid media behind it to make sure that it's being seen. You know, if you throw a guest post onto a blog somewhere, there's no guarantee that someone's going to see it. You know, you don't know where that traffic is going to come from and whether it's going to get a lot of views or just a few. When you're doing a paid program, you know, a native advertising program, you're buying paid media to drive the exact right eyeballs to that article. So there's a little more control there. You're able to better control the outcome and ensure that you're getting the traffic that you want and also as much as you want.
As a journalist, how do you feel when people send proposals to you and they ask you to promote their brands and for guest posts?
You know, I think a lot of it kind of aligns with the things we've been saying. You know, I used to be a columnist for Inc. and I would get proposals in my inbox every single day of people who wanted me to write about them or wanted to you know, submit themselves as a topic for an article. And the most successful ones are the ones that really, really listen and really understand where their content is going to show up. Because if you're just sending the same pitch to 50 different blogs, someone's going to know that. And there's no possible way the same article is a perfect fit for 50 different blogs. So it's a little more labor intensive. You got to spend more time, you know, identifying the right people and the right places and the right topics for each of those different environments. You know, I think, again, you know, if the editor or whoever manages submissions gets the feeling that this is just a numbers game for you and you're just trying to pitch anything and anyone, they're going to feel that. It's going to feel different. It's not going to feel special or custom. It's just going to feel like a copy paste. And if that's the case, then why would they want an article that you've already pitched to 40 other places, you know? So it is a numbers game, but, you know, it's a custom numbers game. You've got to put the effort in and the time in to make sure that each pitch you're sending out is highly customized to the exact audience and the exact environment where you want that content to live.
What's an example of a really, really good pitch that you received?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best pitches I received was from a consultant. And what she did is she emailed me and she said, I noticed that you write on this topic frequently. And she provided some examples that said to me, she reads my column. She knows my expertise. She knows what kind of content I create. So I knew that this was custom just for me, right? And then she said, I think that your audience would be interested in the following thing, which is my expertise. I would love to provide you with 5 tips on how your audience can be more efficient at whatever it was, right? So it was highly custom in that it was, this email only could have come to me because it included references to my work. And then she was telling me why she thought it was valuable for my audience. Not, hey, I'd love to get some press, right? But really showing up in service of my readers, which is my goal as a writer or as an editor, is I want my readers to be happy. So, you know, she was really understanding my position and what it was that I was trying to accomplish and feeding into that. The other thing she did was provided everything I needed to be able to say yes. So she provided me with information. She provided me with contact information for references for people who could be quoted in this article. And she provided me with some photos that I could use to help make that article come to life. So, you know, she made it pretty hard to say no. It's the difference between showing up and saying, hey, make me a pizza, and showing up and saying, hey, I brought all these ingredients and I know you love pizza. Why don't we make it together?
Yeah, I can see that. At the same time, I do see why most businesses focus more on showing off their products, because that's really what we have, or services, instead of just entertaining people.
You know, like I said, I'm not disillusioned to think that any business is just going to stop making content about their products. You have to do that. It's very important. But I think that makes sense on your properties, on your website, on your social channels, where people's expectation is hearing from you. If you are sort of, you know, going somewhere else where that's not the expectation, then you have to adjust and recognize, what is the context of this place? What do people come here for? Because it's not my website. They're not coming to entrepreneur.com to hear about me. They're coming to learn or to find examples or case studies. So how can I provide that? What is it that people want when they show up here, and how can I give them that?
On your website, you mentioned brand storytelling. Do you have any resources or books that you can recommend?
You know, like I said, I think the Storytelling Edge, that new book from the guys at Contently, I think is really great, because they're actually looking at storytelling from the perspective of brands and saying, how do you tell better brand stories? And so I think that book is a great example. Another one that I read, and it's sort of unrelated, but it's a book called Exactly What to Say by Phil Jones. It's really a book about sales, but what's interesting about it and how it applies to the content world is it's really about the importance of word choice and how the words that you select to put your message out in the world can really dramatically impact the outcomes. And so you have to choose your words carefully, and understanding, you know, what your words say and what they mean and the weight that they carry. I think if you are in the content world, then even though it might seem on its face like a sales book, it's actually very important for understanding how to put your message into the world and get the results that you want.
Where can people find you?
If people want to learn more about me, you can check out my website. It's mdeziel.com. So mdeziel.com. And my handle on most social networks is also mdeziel. So it shouldn't be too hard to find me.
Okay. We'll add that in the show notes.
Excellent.
And thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect, Liebelt. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.